I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. In a world with competing interests, cooperation just isn't always going to be easy. But is cooperation actually sometimes very natural? Well, of course it is. Just think of a pack of wolves or an insect colony, ants or bees, I don't care what kind of a colony it is. It's not always a dog-eat-dog world. We do see cooperation at various levels, within and sometimes between species. Nicola Rehani is author of The Social Instinct, How Cooperation Shaped the World. She's a Royal Society University Research Fellow and a professor of evolution and behavior at University College London, where she leads the Social Evolution and Behavior Lab. She has a treasure trove of stories to tell about animals that give each other a leg up, as it were, in social ways, and this seems to benefit the group. Of course, life has its winners and losers, and the world is rife with competition. I don't want to deny that. Still, a little self-sacrifice for the good of the group isn't necessarily something we all have to be cynical about. Nicola Rehani, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Hi, Marcus. Thank you for inviting me on the show.
Before we get to talking about cooperating animals, I understand you've done some observation of humans, too, specifically about what can happen when humans have to share a kitchen sink. And you've drawn some parallels, I guess, to animals, too. What's with the kitchen sink business?
So, yeah, that's true. I did an experiment on my unwitting colleagues when I worked at the Institute of Zoology in London. And the experiment was trying to test this idea that if you see evidence of other people not cooperating, that can make you more likely to then defect or free ride yourself. And so we used our staff tea room kitchen sink as the experimental setting. And as anybody who's ever shared a house or a staff room or any kind of shared environment where you're sharing a shared space with other people, as anyone who's been in that situation will know, it's very difficult to keep these places clean because there's always a temptation for individuals to leave their own dirty items lying around and leave them for other people to clear up. And so what I did was to test this idea that basically seeing evidence of free riding, this kind of broken windows type effect, actually then prompts further free riding from other people. So what I did was I went into work every day very early for a few weeks, and I manipulated the cleanliness of this shared staff room sink. So on Sundays, I would do all the washing up and leave it very nice and clean, and then record how many items would be subsequently added to the sink. And on other days, I left one or two or three items in the sink and then also measured how many items would be subsequently added. And the results are not rocket science. Anyone who's ever shared a flat with anyone or anything like that will know what happened in this experiment. On the days where the sink started clean, it tended to stay clean. Whereas on the days where the sink was seeded with dirty items by me, where a teaspoon or a cup was left in the sink, then that licensed people to leave their own dirty items in the sink. And so we call this something like the twofold cost of free riding. Because by leaving your own dirty stuff in the sink, not only do you make the sink, you know, no longer a clean place, but you also incentivize other people to do the same thing. And so things just rapidly spiral and you end up with a very dirty staff room sink in this case.
Well, you said this is not rocket science, but I see you going at this scientifically anyway. I mean, you quantified this.
Yeah, we did. So we were interested in whether, for example, is leaving two or three things in the sink worse than leaving one thing? And it turns out that it is. So leaving one thing is bad, but, you know, leaving evidence of everybody's defecting here, there's like five or six items in the sink, that's worse. And that licenses more people to leave their own things in the sink as a consequence. And so we were just testing this very well-known idea from game theory, which is called conditional cooperation, and which has been shown lots and lots of times in very artificial laboratory settings, which is that people are more willing to cooperate if they think other people are cooperating, and they're more likely to defect or to free ride if they think that other people in their group are free riding as well. And so what we really wanted to do in this experiment was not necessarily to show that conditional cooperation occurs, but to show it in this very intuitive real world setting that everybody is familiar with.
Well, I wanted to start with sort of human behavior to begin with, and then I'm hoping we can all keep this in mind as we proceed in the conversation with you, because I want to turn now to animals, and obviously we're going to see ourselves as a foil to all of this, whatever you have to say about animal cooperation. But when I say animals, maybe I've misspoken already, because I want to go microscopic. Can we talk about cooperation really on a very small level, not just maybe between cells, but even inside of cells?
Sure. I mean, when we look in the mirror, what we think we see is an individual. And in some senses, that is the case. So you look in the mirror, you see yourself, but you're simultaneously an individual and a collective. And you're a collective because every multicellular body, and yours is one of them, is made up of genes cooperating inside genomes and cells working together to make this coherent entity that we see when we look in the mirror. And so, yes, it does make sense to talk of the genes inside our bodies as being cooperative, as working together for a greater good. And a corollary of that is that sometimes there's also competition that happens inside our bodies, where some selfish genetic elements or selfish cells in some cases try to stack the deck in their own favor, and they try to overrepresent themselves relative to the others. And for example, when that happens in a cellular context, when we see some cells trying to overrepresent themselves relative to the others, we normally call the disease that results from that cancer. And so we see even our bodies are this tension really between cooperation and free riding and cheating in some senses.
So is there, however, a kind of overrepresentation where it stops short of that threshold where you would call it cancer, where this is still normal and it is conducive to the health of the larger organism?
I think cancer occurs when a cell or a group of cells stops responding to the normal instructions that are given out by the body, by all the other cells in the body. And specifically, the kinds of instructions that are ignored by cancer cells are instructions to stop growing and instructions to kill themselves. So sometimes the cells in your body are given instructions from the other cells that say, okay, it looks like something's gone a bit wrong here. Now is a time for you to self-destruct. And usually most of the cells in our body obey those kinds of cellular instructions that come from the neighboring cells. And what happens when we have cancerous cells is that they start to ignore those instructions from their neighbors, and they over-replicate themselves relative to the others, and they steal more of their fair share of resources from the bloodstream. They divert resources from the body, and they manage to evade all of the host's attempts to control them, or in some cases, at least, they manage to evade these attempts to control them. And, you know, in some ways, then we see this kind of selfish strategy that has a very devastating impact on the integrity of the collective, on the host organism.
So I guess I'm kind of meditating about all of this, fishing a little bit in my mind for a good analogy, and I'm thinking there's a huge differentiation of cell types in a complex organism. You can have cells in the bone or in the muscle or in fatty tissues or in the heart or in organs or skin. Is it too simple just to say that a complex organism is a cooperative enterprise where, if it's healthy, if it's not cancerous, if it's not destroying itself with maybe an autoimmune response, if things are going right, you've got a team and they're doing teamwork?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's, I think that's a great analogy. And sometimes when I talk about this, if I'm giving a presentation with slides, I have a really nice slide that I show, which shows you the shell of a car and then all of the pieces that comprise that car laid out in front of it. And in some ways, you can think of our bodies as being a bit like that car with all its constituent pieces and componentry. And we're made up of lots and lots of subunits and smaller subunits within them that all work together for this greater good, that to make this collective that we call the individual, in much the same way that cars are made up of things like steering wheels and pistons and crankshafts that give rise to this coherence and this sense of purpose when you view those things all together working as a car does. And so I think that the analogy you gave, it is really apt, actually, and that, you know, our bodies are feats of teamwork. And usually, and hopefully for most of us, that cooperation is maintained. And we do manage to keep those selfish entities that might otherwise disrupt that coherence in check.
So let's make the leap now to something like an insect colony, because I'm guessing that the temptation for most of us is that you see a bee, a lone bee hovering over a flower. And yeah, we've been taught in school that it's part of a whole and there's the greater colony. But it's so tempting to see that thing in isolation from it, the full organism. I guess the colony is the full organism.
Well, some people think that that is a useful way to think about social insect colonies. And I think that the idea has a lot of merit, that rather than seeing all the individual ants or bees, for example, as being individuals in their own right, it can make more sense to think of the entire colony as being the individual. And these, the bees and the ants that comprise the colony are subunits that are part of that, what we call superorganism. And so just to give you some reasons why people think that this kind of distinction is helpful, in these really highly social insect colonies, we call them eusocial insect colonies, there's normally just one reproductive individual who's the queen, and all the other individuals, the workers, are sterile, and their main role in life is to help the queen to produce offspring. Now, when we look at our own bodies, our multicellular bodies, we see that actually that same reproductive division of labor is also apparent inside our bodies. So it's only our sex cells that are reproductive and that can pass genetic material to the next generation. And all the rest of the cells in our body are what we call somatic cells. They're not reproductive. And their main job is to guide these sex cells in a way, or to protect them so that they can be passed into, so they can pass their genetic material into future generations. There are also really cool parallels between the way that some social insect colonies function and the way that our bodies, our multicellular bodies function. So for example, a honeybee colony can thermoregulate. It can regulate its core temperature. And it does this by having some bees whose job is to vibrate their muscles at a very high frequency if the temperature of the colony is too low. And that vibration of the bees' muscles generates heat, and that helps to heat the colony up. And there are some other bees, in fact, whose job it is to shuttle fuel to the vibrating bees, because that's a very energetically demanding thing to do. And so we see that bees are able to warm the colony up when the temperature is too low, and they're also able to cool the colony down when the temperature gets too high, in just the same way that we, you know, can shiver and sweat when our temperature is either too low or too high. The bees are able to reduce the temperature of the colony by spraying water over the inside of the hive, and that water evaporates, which then has a cooling effect on the colony. There are lots of other ways I can talk about how we can find these parallels between the ways that social insect colonies function and the ways that our bodies function. I mean, another really nice example is that they have a kind of immune system or an immune response. And if you introduce a pathogen into an ant colony, for example, the ants will sequester themselves away. So the ants that are responsible for looking after the queen and the brood, which is the most valuable part of the colony, will sequester themselves very deep inside the colony so that they don't come into contact with these potentially infected individuals. And in fact, the infected individuals will take themselves off to die in social isolation. And that's another protective measure that these colonies have that helps to secure the interests of the colony as a whole and of the reproductive individuals in particular. And we know that our cells inside our bodies do something very similar as well. If they are infected or if they are damaged in some way, our cells will destroy themselves. It's a process called apoptosis, and it's simply cellular death, which is self-controlled. And so I think there are lots of lovely comparisons to be drawn between social insect colonies and multicellular bodies. And I think it really does make sense to think of these highly social insect colonies as being organisms in their own right in some respects.
Well, while we're here talking about insect colonies, I hadn't heard about Brazilian ants and the self-sacrifice of some of the individuals at nighttime. This is not just in terms of a pathogen, but just to secure the safety of the colony at night. They close up shop and then some of them are left outside and die?
Yeah, this is a really lovely and poignant example of cooperation that occurs in an ant species called Ferelius puzulus. And these Ferelius ants live in very hot, dry regions in Brazil. And their nest is underground. That's where they're safe and they're able to keep the nest temperature constant. So the nest is underground, but during the day, the ants forage above ground. So they leave the safety of the nest and they go into the world to find food. And at the end of the day, they return to the nest and they go back underground to the safety of their nest there. But a few individuals don't go back into the nest at night. So every night, a few individuals will wait at the surface and they wait for all the other ants to scurry down the tunnel and scurry into the safe nest before they then get to work by dragging and carrying grains of sand and other debris to completely conceal that nest entrance from the outside. But in doing this, these workers at the surface seal their own fate because they can't survive overnight alone above ground. So they will die now. But their heroism, it doesn't even end at this point because they don't want to die too close to the nest because that could also put the colony in danger. That could attract predators, for example. So once they've made sure the nest entrance is completely concealed, these worker ants at the surface will turn around and march off into the night somewhere to die somewhere that isn't close to the nest. And in doing that, they help to protect their relatives. And of course, they share copies of the same genes with these relatives. And so from an evolutionary point of view, we can understand how this behavior could be favored by natural selection.
But is there a way to look at that ant that marches off as though it's, I mean, we're so tempted to think of it as a sentient creature that's thinking this through. And maybe it's more like the cell that dies within the human body, that it just kind of happens of its own accord and there's no I don't even know how to say this, but there's no kind of reasoned decision-making that happens there.
Yeah, you're totally right. And this is one of the themes, actually, that I draw out in my book, which is that, you know, it's very tempting when we look at the behavior of non-human species to attribute lots of complicated mental or psychological processes underpinning those behaviors. And so it's very tempting, for example, if we look at this ant, to wonder whether the ant, you know, the ants that stay at the surface, are they worried? Do they love their sisters? Are they doing this out of a sense of duty and all these kinds of things? And in fact, you know, it's highly, highly unlikely that there's anything like that kind of cognition involved. And as you said, it's much more likely that these behaviors are entirely pre-programmed and innate to some extent, and are done without any kind of cognitive reflection whatsoever. And what the main point here is that, you know, we can see examples of altruism in our own species, and heroism and things like this in our own species. And we can see them in very distant species, like the ants that I just described. And so it's not, the differences between humans and non-human species isn't always about the kinds of behaviors that we do. But I think a lot of the time, the key differences are in the cognitive mechanisms that support those behaviors. And I use this metaphor of thinking about the behavioral destination and the cognitive journey taken to get there. And I think really when we're thinking about comparing our own behavior with the behavior of other species on the planet, that is a really helpful metaphor to keep in mind, because we often get to the same behavioral destination as other species, but humans also often take a quite different cognitive journey to get there.
Nicola Rehani is with us. She's author of The Social Instinct, How Cooperation Shaped the World. We're going to take a short break and then invite her to take us to the Kalahari to hear about babblers, a type of bird, and their social behavior. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. It's a great pleasure to have Nicola Rehani with us. She's author of The Social Instinct, How Cooperation Shaped the World. And Nicola Rehani, I want to hear about, this is so surprising to me, mole rats that also behave not unlike maybe an ant colony with a queen, with royalty in the colony. I'm not accustomed to hearing about this when we're talking about mammals.
Yeah, the mole rats are really extraordinary mammals. And there's two extremely social species of mole rat that live in sub-Saharan Africa. And some people might have heard of the naked mole rat. They're quite unusual looking. They sort of pink, naked, little mousy things, but with their teeth protruding from the outside of their lips and a slightly sort of horror show appearance. So the naked mole rats are pretty well known because of their appearance largely. And the other very social species of mole rat that I've worked on a little bit is called the Damaraland mole rat. And they are marginally more appealing visually than the naked mole rat because they have a bit of fur, but they still have these quite ghastly teeth protruding from the outsides of their lips. And what these two species of mole rats have in common is that they live in intensely social groups, intensely social family groups, in fact, in very deep underground tunnels. And in both species, reproduction within a group is entirely monopolized by a single breeding pair. And some people call them the king and the queen, or you can call them the dominant male and the dominant female. But this dominant pair produce almost 100% of all the offspring that will be born in any group. And everybody else in the group, all the other individuals, which in a Damaraland colony could be around 15 or 16 other mole rats, and in a mole rat colony could be tens of other mole rats, all the others are relegated to helper status. So they don't get to breed. Most of them don't get to breed at any point during their lifetime. And instead, their main role in life is to help to raise the offspring of the dominant pair.
Yeah, that's just, I mean, do we have any other mammals? Are there dominant males, dominant females in large, I don't know, packs of mammals elsewhere?
So it's normally the kind of this sort of terminology, we use it quite often in species that we describe as being cooperatively breeding species. So this is it's not a common state of affairs, but it's more common in species that live in unpredictable and difficult environments. So some of the other mammals that people might be familiar with that are also cooperative breeders are things like meerkats and wolves, African wild dogs or African hunting dogs are cooperative breeders. And in fact, actually, humans are cooperative breeders as well. So, you know, this is something that we have in common in some respects with these other very exotic sounding creatures.
Yeah. So once again, if we were to talk about the collective society, or I don't know that I can say organism, if we're talking then about, you know, a group of humans or a group of wolves or a group of mole rats. But once again, if reproduction is confined to just one small quadrant of the whole, that's not unlike a beehive.
Yeah. So there are definitely parallels. The main difference, I would say, is just in the extent of that reproductive skew. So in a eusocial insect colony, the ants, the bees, the wasps, workers are often physiologically sterile. That means they're born as sterile individuals, and they just simply can't breed even if the opportunity presents itself. So they are really at one very, very extreme end of the spectrum. We don't see that as much in vertebrate species. So we don't see that as much in the cooperatively breeding mammals and the cooperatively breeding birds. What we see in these species, in the mammals and the birds, is that the helpers are physiologically capable of breeding. It's just that they don't often get the chance to do it. So they're prevented from breeding either because they don't very often encounter non-relatives. So they never really encounter breeding partners that they can successfully mate with or that they would mate with. Or in the case of, say, something like the meerkats, even if they do encounter unrelated opposite sex partners, and then let's say you're a female meerkat, you meet an unrelated male who's on a foray at your group and you become pregnant. For that female, when she gives birth to the pups in the group, there's a very high chance that the dominant female will kill and eat those pups. Even though quite often the pups that the dominant female is killing and eating are her own grandchildren or her nieces and nephews, there's this very apparent conflict over who is going to get to breed. And the control over reproduction in the mammal and the bird species is exerted a lot of the time by the dominant individuals preventing the subordinates from breeding. Whereas what we see in the insects, as I said, is more like this. They've taken things one step further, and the workers have actually evolved to be physiologically sterile. Yeah. To be physiologically incapable of breeding.
You've mentioned birds now, and that's the perfect invitation for me to mention the Kalahari and babblers. I don't know much about babblers. Apparently, you've spent a fair amount of time with babblers. What are they?
So babblers are a lovely little bird that lives in the Kalahari Desert. And the simplest way to think of them is they are a bit like meerkats with wings. So they live in the same kinds of places as meerkats. They live in these in the Kalahari, in very dry regions. And they also live in groups that are quite similar to the kinds of groups that meerkats live in. So they live in tight-knit family groups where just one male and one female breed, and everybody else is a helper. The helpers are usually the retained offspring of the breeding pair that stay at home and help their parents to raise their siblings, essentially, rather than breeding themselves. And at some point, as these young birds get older and they mature, they will often try to attain their own breeding position, either in their home group if they can, or in some cases they will disperse, they will leave, and they'll try to find their own breeding position elsewhere.
You know, in all of this discussion we've had about the instinct to cooperate or organized groups of animals that do cooperate, however this is, it's fascinating to me that we've talked about insects and we've talked about birds and mammals. And you've done justice to this topic by including fish. And would you take us and tell us a little bit about cooperation among, I guess, cleaner fish?
Sure. So one of the reasons that cleaner fish are interesting is that they do something that's very similar to what we do. So far, all of the examples of cooperation that we've talked talked about have been cooperation occurring within the confines of family groups. And from an evolutionary perspective, we understand that because individuals that are related to one another can help copies of their genes that are present in their relatives to find their way into future generations if they help those relatives. But that clearly can't be what's going on when we think about cooperation between non-relatives and even cooperation between complete strangers. And we know that this is something that humans do a lot of. We regularly help people that we're not related to, even people we, you know, we don't know or we might never even meet in the case of, say, giving to charity. And it turns out that in that respect, we have rather a lot in common with this small fish, this cleaner fish that lives on coral reefs throughout the Indo-Pacific. So the cleaner fish is about 6 to 10 centimeters long. It's not a very big fish. And it holds these small cleaning stations, small territories that we call cleaning stations on coral reefs. And all the other fish that live on the reef, who we call the clients, will visit those cleaning stations to have a cleaning service, which involves having ectoparasites removed from the surface of their skin. And the cleaner fish, of course, gets a meal in return, gets to eat these ectoparasites. So far, this all sounds pretty harmonious. And, you know, the clients get the ectoparasites removed and the cleaner fish gets a meal. And it seems like that should kind of be the end of the story. But in fact, there's a conflict of interest between cleaner fish and the clients, because what the cleaner fish would prefer to eat if they're given the chance, and if you give them an anesthetized client who doesn't respond, what they do eat is the client's living tissues. So the cleaner fish will prefer to eat mucus and living scales. So now we see that actually things are quite interesting, because there's this conflict between the cleaners on the one hand, who would like to eat the living tissues, and the clients who want the cleaner fish to, you know, remove ectoparasites and not to bite them, because that's harmful to the clients. And we can ask how this conflict is resolved in a system where they can't sit down and talk about it. They can't leave a review on a forum because they got a bad service at a cleaning station. You know, they haven't got like other fish swimming around that are the police or someone that's sort of going to, you know, make sure that everything is happening as it should. So all of these things that we think of as being important for sustaining cooperation in our own societies are absent in this underwater setting. And yet somehow cooperation is maintained. And so the really interesting question is, well, how do they do it? What tools do the clients have up their sleeves to encourage or to force the cleaner fish to feed against its preference?
That's a cliffhanger right there for me.
Okay. So, well, it turns out that actually, even in terms of the mechanisms that are used to sustain cooperation, we have quite a lot in common with cleaner fish. So the two key mechanisms that seem to be very important for sustaining cooperation in this system are punishment and a form of reputation-based partner choice.
This is involved.
Yeah, I mean, it actually, in some ways, I think it's very interesting and satisfying, if that's the right word, to see that the same mechanisms that we think are important in sustaining cooperation in our own interactions are also being used in a kind of different way in this very, very different scenario in the species that we've got very little in common with from an evolutionary point of view, and which nevertheless faces the same kinds of problems, or the problems with the same kinds of incentive structures that we do in our lives, where cooperation is the best mutual outcome, but there might be this kind of temptation to get a short-term advantage or to do something that's to your benefit but slightly screws your partner over. And so I do think it's fascinating that evolution has found similar solutions to these kinds of similar problems, despite the fact we obviously the species in question are very different.
Well, you said punishment and then a matter of prestige. To me, if I were to find a common denominator there, it seems like there might be some kind of shaming that happens.
So what happens with punishment is that if a cleaner cheats a client, it's painful for them. They get bitten. It hurts. And you can see it. If you're watching these clients underwater, they visibly jolt, they shake, and you can really see when a cleaner fish has bitten them. And often what a client will do if a cleaner fish bites it is it will aggressively chase the cleaner fish. And that has the consequence of making the cleaner fish behave more cooperatively in the immediate short-term aftermath of that punishment. So a client who is bitten by a cleaner fish can chase them around, and that cleaner fish will be less likely to bite that client in the immediate aftermath of the punishment. It's a bit more complicated what's going on with the image scoring or the reputation mechanism, because here what happens is that when a cleaner fish is servicing a client, sometimes other clients will wait. They're waiting at the cleaning station and they're waiting for their turn to be serviced. And while they're waiting, they will watch what's happening with the current interaction. I mean, I guess in a way it's kind of similar to you go down to the barber shop and you have to sit on that little sofa while someone else is getting their hair cut and you're waiting. And so you just kind of, what are you going to do? You're going to watch what's happening. And so in this situation, the clients are watching what's happening. And if they see that interaction ending badly, so if the current client seems to get a bad service, which they can observe because they can see either the current client chasing the cleaner fish aggressively or fleeing away from the cleaner fish. If the ones that are waiting on this metaphorical sofa see this kind of bad ending to an interaction, they will sometimes swim away and go to a different cleaning station instead. They will exercise their outside options.
Yeah.
And cleaner fish are aware that they're being watched. They know if there's a queue of clients waiting, they will give a better service to their current client to avoid this situation where everybody in the queue swims off and goes somewhere else. And so we see this sort of rudimentary concern for reputation in cleaner fish in much the same way that we know that humans manage our own reputation. And again, just to echo that point that we made earlier about this behavioral destination, but different cognitive journeys, there's no evidence at all that cleaner fish are able to take the perspective of the client or that they understand why a client might swim away if they bite their current client. There's really not very much sophisticated cognition going on here. The cleaner fish can achieve this apparent feat of reputation management just through very simple trial and error learning. It can simply learn that if I bite the current client, then everybody else at my cleaning station swims away, and that is a negative reinforcer. And it can just learn not to do that thing next time.
Yeah.
So they really don't understand why this is happening. But nevertheless, it gives the appearance of this sort of very sophisticated behavioral mechanism for enforcing cooperation.
In our last couple of minutes, you've given so many examples of cooperation here among animals. I'm just wondering, and this is maybe a bit of an unfair question, but, you know, we humans, we tend to think of ourselves as exceptional, and we set ourselves so far apart from other species. And I'm wondering if when you observe these kinds of phenomena where animals work together, do you see us as less exceptional, we humans?
I think the key thing for me is that humans are just another animal on this enormous, bushy, sprawling tree of life. And we are one of a number of animals that lives a social life. And we can definitely find lots of behavioral parallels when we look to other species that live in social groups. We can find lots of behavioral parallels with what we see in our own species and what we see in other species. And often those parallels are not the places that we might think of as being the most obvious. So often the things where we find behaviors in common with other species, we're not finding those same behaviors in chimpanzees and gorillas and orangutans, but we're finding them in meerkats and cleaner fish and pied babblers. So I think one big lesson is that there can be this sort of understandable urge to look to our closest living relatives when we want to find behaviors that we think of as being quintessentially human. And we can often reflexively look to the other great apes and to primates. But in fact, ecological similarity or creatures that face the same kinds of ecological demands as humans would have faced ancestrally, and that we still do face to a great extent nowadays, will often be the best place to look for behaviors that we find resonate with our own. So that's one big thing. But then I do think, despite having said that we can find these many behavioral similarities with other species, and that they can be from many, many different branches of the tree of life, the thing that I really think sets humans apart from other species, and where we do start to find these points of divergence, is in the cognition that we use to support social behavior. And that is where I think we do see some really, really big differences, and where humans are able to, for example, understand another individual's knowledge state, or to understand another individual's beliefs and perspectives. That's what psychologists call theory of mind. And the ability to be able to do that changes some of the strategies you're able to use to support cooperation. It changes, for example, your ability to manage your own reputation, because you can understand how, if you do something, how that might affect another person's impression of you. And there's just no evidence that we know of that any other species on Earth can do this sort of thing. And even young children can't do it. Before they're about 5 years old, young children can't do this kind of cognitive acrobats, if you like, acrobatics. So for me, I think it's sort of, the answer is kind of twofold. I think there's a lot of similarities, but I think where the points of divergence are is in the cognition that we use to support cooperation. And in that sense, I really think that humans are different, and that's where the real differences are to be found.
Amazing stories you tell, and thank you so much for being with us to share them with us.
Thank you.
Nicola Rehani is author of The Social Instinct, How Cooperation Shaped the World. I'm always being reminded that animals are far more complex than we tend to think. So many of their behaviors just don't seem to make sense from a strict evolutionary standpoint. I'm going to include in this category of what I'm talking about the experience of grief in an animal, particularly when an animal ultimately needs to let go of its dead infant. We saw this a few years back with that orca whale carrying her dead calf for something like 2 weeks. Something similar happens apparently with baboons, and we're going to bring that story to you next on Constant Wonder. Stay with us. I'm Marcus Smith. This is Constant Wonder. From our conversation so far this hour about the cooperation we can observe among some animals, even self-sacrificing behavior, we're going to turn now to the issue of the death of a loved one within the animal kingdom. Why do orca whales and various primate mothers carry their young after death? How can we explain any of this without comparing it with our own human grief? I spoke with Alicia Carter, a lecturer in evolutionary anthropology at University College London. Here's part of the conversation. We get into it right here with a remarkable story of a baboon troop that carried and cared for the body of a dead infant of another member of the group who had gone missing.
What happened was the mother of a small infant, so a not yet weaned infant, had disappeared. We assumed that she had been either predated or succumbed to poachers or something like that. But surprisingly, her infant, her six-week-old infant, survived her death and was carried by members of the troop for a couple of days before she also obviously died, because she didn't have a mother that was lactating for her. And then in the subsequent couple of days, some other individuals who were completely unrelated to this dead infant continued to care for it after its death. And this just got me, I was actually pregnant at the time, and it just got me so curious about how mothers and others respond to death.
Now, I was not expecting you to pull in the personal connection. I mean, were you able to stay the scientist during that time of gestation for yourself? Because it was getting pretty close to home.
Yeah, it was a bit shocking. I guess I was a bit more fascinated because I was Yeah, because I was imminently going to have an infant to care for. I hope I was able to remain objective. I certainly took a lot of very extensive field notes that look objective at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
But that particular event is what propelled me to collate all of the ones that we had seen that were, I guess what you could say, were more typical of primate behavior. So where individuals just carry the offspring for varying lengths of time, which is actually well known as a primate mother behavior, but very rarely documented scientifically.
Now, I know that you don't study whales. I know that you're spending time on the ground in Namibia to do this kind of thing. However, I want to go back to the idea of carrying, just the verb, to carry the corpse of an infant. What does that really entail, carrying it? The orca seemed to be nudging the baby upward so that it could breathe, you know, to have access to oxygen. But what kinds of tasks or functions, any nurturing behaviors that you saw among the baboons?
Yeah, it's a great question. So they do actually continue to perform many of the behaviors that you see them performing to live offspring. I mean, I would like to come back to whether they understand that their offspring is dead or not. But in addition to carrying the offspring, which they tend to do anyway, especially when the infant's really small, they'll walk tripedally holding the infant against their chest because it's not yet strong enough to hold on well. But they also groom the corpse and clean the corpse. I mean, it's fascinating. We saw one individual in the population, well, actually two in the end, but one mother and another individual who cleaned out the mouth of the corpse as well. So this kind of nurturing behavior, what you identified in the orca, for example, trying to push the whale offspring, the calf, to the surface, that kind of behavior seems to be common across across mammals that can perform these behaviors post-mortem. The interesting thing, I think, for the cetacean and the primate cases is that they are able to bring their corpse with them. So, for example, there's quite a few studies that have described, for example, giraffe responses to their infants' deaths. So they tend to stay around the corpse and be unable to leave, and they'll stay there for a couple of hours, sometimes for a day or two, but they can't pick the corpse up and carry it, and they must leave to forage. So I think that part of the reason that it's so common in primates and cetaceans is they have a way of pushing the calf or carrying the corpse, the infant, along with them.
Haven't you also seen examples of less than nurturing types of carrying, kind of dragging of the corpse?
Yeah, exactly. So this gets to, well, where I sit on the aware or not of death. but yeah, so that within a very short period of time, the mothers of these deceased infants will start carrying the corpses in a very odd way compared to how they normally carry it. So they'll drag them along the ground, for example, or they'll chimpanzees, for example, will throw them over a shoulder and carry them in the neck pocket, so the gap between the chin and the shoulder. So they start carrying the corpse very, very differently, quite quickly, generally after the death of the infant, which for me seems like some sort of evidence that they're aware that the infant is dead. And I would say that is evidence that they're aware that the infant is dead, because if the infant is injured, they behave very differently. So, for example, if an infant is lethargic because it's ill, or if it has a large injury, the mother tends to change her, well, at least in baboons, tends to change her behavior to accommodate what the infant can do, and can respond in a relevant way to the infant, which is very different when that infant is not alive anymore.
So is it fair for me to draw the comparison between the human wishes and desires and hopes and fears and then superimpose that on animal species?
It's so hard. I'm actually a classically trained zoologist. So my first answer should be no, we shouldn't. The term for that is anthropomorphize. I was trained to reject that forcefully. But there's been a recent, I think it's called the animal turn, a recent shift in how we think about comparing animal behavior to human behavior. So now that I'm in anthropology department, I feel more comfortable saying that, yes, I think that we can compare human behavior directly with animal behavior. And in some cases, some people have made the argument that it's actually more parsimonious, given our shared evolutionary history, to suggest that we have a shared emotional mechanism that underlies our behavior, for example, rather than thinking that only humans have these particular behaviors that we're interested in, like bereavement or grief or mourning.
Have you come around to thinking it possible then that a baboon mother might be in grief and in a season of bereavement?
Yes. I'm definitely on that side of the fence. There's some really interesting data actually that came out of a study in Mauritania on the same species of baboon. And this wasn't looking at responses to dead infants, but to dead conspecific, so adults who had been predated by lions, for example, or hyena. And they looked at the hormonal response that those females, the particular females, had if they had lost a close associate to predation. And they found that, so for example, if a mother lost her adult daughter, who she was a good friend with, so they spent a lot of time and groomed together, and then she had raised cortisol compared to the other individuals in the group for about, I think it was about a month afterwards, which is exactly the same kind of hormonal response that you get in humans who are bereaved. So cortisol increases, sleep is disrupted. There's a whole suite of physiological things that happen when we're grieving. And one of those has been shown in this group of baboons who have lost a close associate. So I would definitely say that it's possible that they are grieving.
Is that inevitable that as a human, we almost have to at least try out that hypothesis that even at the risk of anthropomorphizing, I don't know how we can really be detached and objective about this and not ask that question. I couldn't.
Well, I totally think it's completely valid to ask that question. Obviously, the scientist in me wants to ask it in a very scientific way with lots of data. I mean, the tricky thing is it's, as you mentioned earlier, it's impossible to access the minds of animals. All we can do is try and access it through their behavior. But we can do that. The more technology we have, the better able we are to quantify behavioral changes in response to these kinds of events. So I think it's entirely plausible and possible and should be studied for sure.
Alicia Carter, an evolutionary anthropologist at University College London. So animals cooperate, they possibly grieve, can they also enjoy the music they make? Why do songbirds sing? That's a question we'll tackle tomorrow here on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.
This has been a summer of adventure with Lisa's Adventure Club.